My name is Terry Frost, and welcome to Paleo Cinema. Okay, this is Paleo Cinema Podcast 44, and how are you? At the moment here in Melbourne, it is hot. I'm talking about 100-degree old-school hot, 38 if you live in one of the civilized places on the planet that isn't America. So what's been happening? Not a hell of a lot. It's been the usual January hiatus for most people. I work through it, but then I always work through. But I did see a number of things, a number of movies at least. Most recently, I saw Up, the Pixar movie, which Disney and Pixar produced. And yes, I did enjoy it. Yes, that montage at the start was fantastic and really shows that Pixar are the go-to guys for quality animation these days. And they seem to be able to balance the needs of adults with the needs of kids without referring to fart jokes and obscure sexual metaphors to do it. And it was a bit of fun. Very imaginative, very good movie. So what else? I did see Trick or Treat. If you haven't seen it, Trick or Treat with an R in the middle is an American horror film. I think it's last year. It's got Brian Cox in it. It's got Anna Paquin. It's got a whole bunch of other people in it. And yeah, it's good old school creepy. Definitely see that one. I know the GTTMC guys, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, are fond of it. And yes, it does have that werewolf striptease scene, which is a little bit unusual. If you're into that sort of film, definitely one to see. I have been watching a number of old things. I watched a 1970s caper movie called 11 Harrow House, which stars Charles Grodin, Candace Bergen, Trevor Howard, James Mason, John Gielgud, which is a bit of fun. It's got a cool little caper in it, robbing a diamond exchange, which is run by John Gielgud, playing one of the great John Gielgud shit roles of all times. And nobody played a shit like John Gielgud did. And yeah, that was a bit of fun. I saw that one originally in the cinemas way back before a lot of you were born. It still has some chops. It's got some really cool 1970s sports cars. So if you're a Top Gear fan, you'll get a lot out of this film just by watching Candace Bergen driving sports cars from the 70s. Very beautiful looking sports cars. And they've got the kind of gutsy roar that you get with old school sports cars. At the moment on cable TV here, there are two movies that suck me in every time I do the channel surfing thing. And I get to the movie channels and these movies are on. I can't not watch them. It's a weird thing. They're hypnotic. I think they're putting some kind of subliminal shit in there, some kind of Videodrome mindfuck software into the video stream. And every time Step Brothers comes on with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, I get sucked in, mostly because it's probably the best thing Will Ferrell ever did. And there are so many funny bits to the film, some of which are almost subliminal. They go past and you don't quite notice them. There's a bit where John C. Reilly's character first has sex with the Will Ferrell character's sister-in-law. And she basically attacks him in a toilet at a restaurant. And there's this tiny little bit where he goes, "Oh, it's all slippery." Which, you know, it's kind of in the middle of a lot of chaos and you don't necessarily hear the line, but in context, it's hilariously funny. Not to everyone's taste, but I keep cacking myself every time I hear that line. The other thing that sucks me in every time I see it, and this one, maybe there's more of a reason for it, is whenever Iron Man comes on to cable, I've got to watch the rest of it. I did resist last time it happened, but I must have watched it 6 times now, just in the background while I'm web surfing and blogging and Facebooking and Twittering and live journaling and whatever else I do. I'll always have Iron Man on in the background. I have seen Jeff Bridges use that little paralysis machine on people about 3,000 times now. I'm looking forward to the new movie when it comes out. I've been geeking out on the old one, so that's been a bit of fun. What else have I watched? I watched The Invisible Boy from the 1950s, which again was on cable, and stars Robbie the Robot and a few nondescript other people and a giant intelligent machine which is trying to take over the world, which is always my kind of thing. On TV, I've been watching Fringe. I watched the first episode of that Spartacus TV series with all the CGI blood. So, you know, somebody gets a smack on the cheek and blood, about 3 gallons of blood will gush out the other side of their head. Looks a bit weird. Does have a lot of nudity in it, which is always good. Does have guy bum nudity and full frontal female nudity, which is something I always have a certain fondness for and can appreciate for purely aesthetic reasons a bit. Yeah, it's weird. It's like they're kind of trying to do 300 for TV, for cable TV. And someone told me that there's a nude scene with Lucy Lawless in it in the second episode, so I'm going to have to wait and see that. Been watching a bit of Supernatural with Sal, but it tends to be Monster of the Week kind of stuff at the moment, so not getting into that as much. Not a lot else. There's probably immense amounts of other things I've watched, and I'll mention one other thing when I'm thinking about one of the two movies I'm doing this week. Yeah, you know, just keeping my hand in. It's a little too hot to go out at times. So when I don't have anything else on, I'll just sit back, see what I've downloaded or see what's on the TV and just groove to it like many others among you. So this time we are doing Listener's Choice. Though I was going to do 3 movies for Listener's Choice this time, but there are a couple of reasons why I didn't. A, I found something else that had been requested and I'm going to do that instead of one of the films. And B, I just didn't get around to watching the movie. I will watch it. I'm going to do a second listener's choice on Paleo Cinema, probably a couple of podcasts from now, where I'll do Slaughterhouse 5, which was requested by my old mate Mondi. And congrats to you and Jules on the imminent baby. And also I'll do Walkabout, the Nick Rogue film, which I did say I was going to do this time, but I kind of wasn't in the headspace for it. A few other things happening domestically, which are need to be dealt with. Nothing life-threatening, a few illnesses around, but doing okay. It's not my illness, by the way. It's other people's, but doing okay, but I just didn't get around to the third thing I was going to do, which in this case was Walkabout. I am going to talk about 2 other films, which I like a lot. The first one is 1941's Sullivan's Travels, an American comedy written and directed by Preston Sturges, and the other one is The Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters, directed by Charles Laughton. Now I'm going to take a little bit of a break and then I'll do some letters and I'll get into the 3 things that I said I was going to do.
Sangria, nachos, lemon heads, my dad's boat. You won't go down cause my dick can float.
We sail around the world and go port to port. Every time I come, I produce a quart.
Put on your life vest, let's drop anchor. There's a nice lady who I like to spank her. Pirate, my name is Jack Sparrow. Take off my pants, she can see my flesh arrow.
Make sure to wax, use your mom's hair. You'll be amazed when I come in your hair.
Pull up the anchor, cause we're leaving dry land. Get below deck with a tick in your hand. Anchor us away and shiver me timbers. We like to fuck ladies with our 8-inch members.
Love me hookers who be a curvy. Ain't had lemons and limes so contracted the scurvy.
Drop the anchor, give that hoe a shout.
Cause I'm using my compass to find a nappy dugout.
As the late Ray Barrett said in a very good Australian movie called Goodbye Paradise, I have this vulgar streak. So that was Boats on Hoes from the soundtrack of Step Brothers. Okay, let's get into it. We did get some correspondence. So there are human beings listening to this stuff, and it's not just robots downloading it off the internet. No. The first email was from Eric in good old Toronto, and he says, "Hi Terry, greetings from Toronto, where is currently a balmy -5°C. One of my minor resolutions for 2010 was to get a bit more involved with the podcast I listen to all the time, hence the email. I really enjoyed the Dick episode, particularly as I've seen all the films you talked about, and Murder, My Sweet is a favourite of mine. As usual, I thought all your observations were spot on, but I'd like to throw in an additional point about how Powell's song and dance past influenced his performance. He's talking about Dick Powell here. Murder, My Sweet enabled Powell to start a new path as an actor, but I think his musical comedy background gave him an assured physicality that helped him pull off a tough guy role. There's one point in the film, I think it's as he's leaving the Grail's house, where he does a quick hopscotch on the Grail's marble-tiled hall. It's not the sort of thing you usually associate with a hard-boiled PI, but in a flash it establishes Marlowe's sense of humour and the absurd while also showing that he is confident and quick on his feet. Powell, not a particularly big man, moved well, and that helped convince the audience that his Marlowe could hold his own when it came to the inevitable rough stuff. Harper is another film I'm very fond of. You noted how it's California's setting overturned noir convention, so maybe it's better described as film Blanche. That's bleached in English and shows the value of several years of high school French. I enjoyed some classes so much that I had to repeat them. If you want a weird genre mashup, track down Lady in Cement, a 1968 Frank Sinatra film in which he plays a Miami-based detective Tony Rome. Much of the film's plot is clearly lifted from Murder, My Sweet / Farewell, My Lovely, with Dan Blocker, Hoss on Bonanza, playing an outsized ex-con who engages Tony Rome to track down an old girlfriend, Raquel Welsh, playing the femme fatale, and Landy Kazan as a go-go dancer. So there's something for the dads. It's certainly not Sinatra's best film, though it has a kind of last gasp of an aging hipster charm, but within the paleo cinema context, it's interesting to compare it to Harper. Harper is the older film, but cars and clothing aside, it's still relevant and has something to offer a contemporary audience. Lady in Cement is particularly interesting for its look in a thankfully vanished era, a Rat Pack period piece caught in cinematic amber. On The Long Goodbye, I saw it 20 years ago in a university film course, and while I've forgotten most of it, the scene where the mobster uses his girlfriend to teach Marlowe an object lesson is burned into my brain. Sorry this has turned into such an epic. I'll close with a recommendation and aim for more brevity in future. You should take a look at Come Drink With Me, a 1966 Shaw Brothers film directed by King Hu and starring Ching Pei Pei. It's a kung fu film, but it stands in relation to most chop socky movies as John Ford Westerns do most cowboy pictures. It's available on DVD from Dragon Dynasty with lots of worthwhile extras. So that's it from me. Thanks for your great podcast. I enjoyed everyone, even the live one from Terry's Dashboard Edition. Best, Eric in Toronto. P.S. I wrote an iTunes review for the show and was surprised to see mine was apparently the first. Tell those other listeners to pull their thumbs out and get over to iTunes. Okay, pull your thumbs out and get over to iTunes. Thanks for that, Eric. Lady in Cement, I've got a copy of it. I got it on like a four-pack of Sinatra movies. Von Ryan's Express was in there, Lady in Cement, and the other one in the Tony Rome series, Tony Rome, the back-to-back Sinatra Tony Rome films with Richard Conte playing the police detective in it, and I like Richard Conte a bit. The interesting thing about that, you said that Dan Blocker was the Moose Morlow type character in Lady in Cement. Oddly enough, Dan Blocker was the original person that Robert Altman wanted to play the Sterling Hayden role in The Long Goodbye, so the films linked together like that. So I really appreciate that one. I'm going to have to track down that. I do like some Shaw Brothers now and then. The Five Venoms is a favourite of mine, and I've really got to get more into that. I know a couple of places around Melbourne, a couple of Asian specialist DVD places, which are quite large and interesting, where I can pick those up fairly inexpensively. I suppose I could download them, but I would like to kind of go with the original if I can. And, it's definitely something that I could look at for future podcasts. So thanks very much for that, Eric. Moving right along, our old buddy Vince at B-Movie Podcast sent a quick email saying, here is some feedback on the last show. Cheers, Vince. Now get back to podcasting. So thank you for that, Vince. I love that in-depth analysis, and I always appreciate hearing from you. I think we've got the kind of relationship where we stir each other as much as we possibly can. But appreciate that, Vince, and thanks for your podcast as well. One of the things I love about podcasting is the fact that there's not a serious rivalry or competition between podcasters. We all try to encourage each other and support each other. And while I'm talking about that, I've got to mention a podcast. Cinecultania. It's a new podcast out of Melbourne. If you type in Cinecultania in however you search for a podcast, you'll find it. It's run by a couple of movie geeks, much younger than myself, Ben and Alex, and they've given a shout out to this podcast already, so thanks for that, both of you. We're going to have to do a meet up with Ben at some stage. We're going to have to get set up for a drink somewhere. I believe, listening to his latest podcast, that he works at ACME, the Australian Centre for the Moving Image, and so we probably should get down to one of those little bars or cafes down around that way and see what we can do and do a bit of movie geek interaction happening there. So definitely on the cards. Got to work it all out. This time of year is a bit chaotic, but we'll get there. And I do recommend their podcast. They're hitting a few Australian ones. For some people, I have talked to at least one person who said they didn't like all the swearing and that. But, yeah, fuck it. I love swearing. I mean, it's one of my favourite things to do besides drinking coffee and watching movies and all the other things I do. But definitely give them a go. They're very knowledgeable and they're very interested in learning more than they already know about movies. And that's one of the things, that passion for learning about films is a big part of movie podcasting. And I always like to see that in anybody. I don't give a stuff whether you're 15 or 5,500. As long as you just keep learning, you're never going to grow old. So the next email after Vince's little brevity is the soul of wit effort. I'll just get my screen back happening here. Is from Rickster, also known as Serps. He says, "Hi Terry, love the latest podcast. Even though you had already decided to do Murder My Sweet before I recommended it, I'm taking credit anyway." Yeah, please do, Rickster. One of the all-time favourite films and one of the best private eye noirs ever made. Like you, I also have some reservations about The Long Goodbye, but I still enjoy it for what it is. What is it exactly? I still haven't made up my mind. As for Harper, I've never seen it, but rest assured it has now leapt at the top of my Netflix queue. Your upcoming Listener's Choice podcast looks to be another great one, even though, shockingly, I haven't seen Walkabout or Sullivan's Travels. I've always wanted to, though. Once again, great podcast as always. Take care, Rickster, a.k.a. Serps. Thank you for that, Rickster. I'm not doing Walkabout this time because I think it needs a little more than I can give to it this time around. But Sullivan's Travels, I saw it once a few years ago. But revisiting it, I have found it a lot of fun. I'm going to have to go back and look at more Sturges. But that's all of the feedback I've got, so shame on everybody else. In the meantime, I'm going to just take a break now, and then we'll get into the actual movies.
Well, now what's it to be, Lord? Another widow? How many's it been? 6? 12? I just remember. You say the word, Lord, I'm on my way. You always send me money to go forth and preach your word. A widow with a little wad of bills hid away in a sugar bowl. Lord, I am tired. Sometimes I wonder if you really understand. Not that you mind the killings. Your book is full of killings. But there are things you do hate, Lord. Perfume-smelling things. Lacy things. Things with curly hair.
That, of course, is Robert Mitchum from Night of the Hunter. I love that line about things with curly hair. There's a double meaning there that really gets to the heart of what kind of sick fuck preacher Harry Powell is in this movie. The Night of the Hunter was made in 1955. It was directed by Charles Laughton, and it's the only film he ever directed, unfortunately. It's based on a 1953 novel by Davis Grubb. I've got a copy of it here. I haven't read it in a long time. Of course, the novel is a lot more graphic than the movie was able to be in the 1950s. But if you are able to find a copy of it, it's a good read. It doesn't actually play the same as the film in the sense that the film is the nightmare of children and the book is a little bit less so. But it does give you a kind of a bigger grounding in the character. Apparently, the character of Harry Powell was based on a real live serial killer from the 1930s, a guy called Harry Powers. If you look at the Wikipedia page for the book of The Night of the Hunter, there's some links there about that particular case and Harry Powers going around killing widow women and things like that. Now, Charles Laughton, of course, being a famous stage and screen actor from the 1920s onwards, really, it's one of the tragedies of cinema that he didn't make any other films. The Night of the Hunter wasn't financially successful at the time. So up until his death, about 9 years after the film was made, Lawton didn't get another opportunity to direct a film. And I think that's a tragedy, because this film, even though it's not perfect and it does have some bits that are a little bit disconcerting, it's one of those first movies that really draws attention to the director in nothing but positive ways. The cinematography was by Stanley Cortez, excellent cinematographer. There's some second unit stuff here in the country town along the Ohio River where a lot of the film takes place, which is beautifully shot. And it's just got that telling eye for detail of 1930s Depression era middle America, which it's one of the things that a foreign director, and of course Lawton being English, brings to a film like this, is that kind of eye for detail, that the things that a local person, somebody from that part of the world, wouldn't notice. Sometimes it is useful to get a director from another place to take a look at it, and so they can kind of draw attention to the things that nobody notices, and to build a world based on those kind of small details. And of course Stanley Cortez, the cinematographer, was the cinematographer on Orson Welles' Magnificent Ambersen, so he was very much recognised for the quality of his work. One of the things that makes this film work is that Lawton, being from the stage originally, was very much into collaboration. So him and Cortez and Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters, who was actually an acting student of Charles Lawton's at the time and for some time afterwards as well, were really collaborating on this. And also Walter Schumann, the guy who did the music. The music's very striking in this film. It combines old-time gospel songs with some very kind of dramatic and strident soundtrack. Lawton's whole idea was to get everybody on board and to get everybody to bring their best to the movie. One of the things Mitchum always said about his career was, if you want my interest, interest me. If you just want my presence, pay me. So with the collaboration with Lawton, one of the things about that for Mitchum was the fact that Lawton interested in him. One of the things that occurred was that Lawton and Mitchum were driving around Los Angeles in a car, and Lawton very shyly admitted to Mitchum that he was a homosexual. And Robert Mitchum just pretended to be shocked and went, "Oh, stop the car, let me out." He didn't give a stuff that Lawton was a homosexual, which is kind of a rare quality in a person from the 1950s, a person who grew up in the 1930s, to have. And one of the things that Lawton said about Mitchum was he was one of the best actors acting at the time, and that in spite of his public persona, he was a very shy man, a very intelligent man, a very well-read man, which from everything I've got about Mitchum is true. He had hid his light under a bushel to a certain extent, and that intelligence and that knowledge and that education that he pretty much did for himself shows in his work, in particularly in a film like Night of the Hunter, which Mitchum has claimed is his best work. Now, I'll give you a bit of a brief plot synopsis for those of you who haven't seen it. The film is set in the 1930s West Virginia along the Ohio River. Ben Harper, played by Peter Graves, is sentenced to hang for his part in a robbery in which two men were killed. Before he's caught, he hides the stolen money, trusting only his son John, Billy Chapin, with the money's location. Harper has a much younger daughter, Pearl, played by Sally Ann Bruce. Harry Powell, Robert Mitchum, a serial killer and self-appointed preacher with the words love and hate tattooed on his knuckles, of his right and left hands, shares a prison cell with Harper. He tries to get Harper to tell him the hiding place before Harper is sentenced to death. But the only clue he gets is a biblical quotation Harper mutters in his sleep, and the child shall lead them. Convinced that Harper told his children the secret, Powell woos and marries Harper's widow, Willa, played by Shelley Winters. Willa is unaware of Powell's motives and is convinced that her marriage will lead to her salvation. Powell questions the children about the money whenever they are alone, but they distrust him and reveal nothing. John especially is suspicious and protective of his sister. One night, Willa overhears her husband questioning the children, and she realises the truth. I won't go on and do the spoilers for that, because if you haven't seen the film, I want to leave the rest of it there, but without doing too much of a spoiler, the children run away from Harry Powell and ride a little skiff down the Ohio River in order to escape from them. Eventually, they find sanctuary with a lady called Rachel Cooper, played by the silent film actress Lillian Gish, an elderly but tough woman who looks after stray children. Powell eventually tracks them down, and there's a climax to the film. It's a child's nightmare. It's almost, it's got fairy tale, big bad wolf kind of qualities to it, in spite of the realistic setting of a lot of the location shooting. There's a bit of a disjunction too between the location shooting and the studio shooting in this film. Studio filming draws attention to itself, particularly in this case, because a lot of the set pieces in the studio are very expressionistic. Lawton frames certain shots in certain rooms in certain ways in order to get an effect, and along with Cortez's assistance, of course, he uses shadow very well, and he has that stark black and white cinematography. It's a really strange journey of a film, this one. The sanctuary the children find with Rachel Cooper is an interesting one too. There's a dynamic between all of the children involved, and the way that she mothers them is very much a tough love kind of thing. She doesn't soft sell the problems they've got. This is during the Depression, remember. There were a lot of lost children in those days. There were children whose parents deserted them, children whose parents died from various diseases. There was a need for people to take in waifs and strays. And Rachel Cooper is that person. Lillian Gish was chosen for this film because Lawton, who served in World War I, I think, as an ambulance driver. As soon as the war ended, the first film we saw was Lillian Gish in a silent movie, and it left a deep impression on him that World War I was, in a lot of ways, a nightmarish war, even compared to World War II. Of course, there were all the Holocaust things in World War II, but for the soldiers themselves, World War I was a much more nerve-wracking and horrifying scenario in a lot of ways. And for an ambulance driver as well, they were front line. They were taking people away from the front line. They were putting themselves under threat and picking up the pieces, literally, from the damage caused by the Western Front. And Lawton was one of those people. And it did have a profound effect on him. I think the fact that he kind of imprinted on the Lillian Gish movie, ultimately, 40 years later, almost 40 years later, led to him casting her in this role. And she is kind of weirdly angelic in this film. She's, in a great way, the antithesis of the Harry Powell film, the selfish, ignoring the truth of human life, self-justifying, crazy fuck that Mitchum played in this film. She's the opposite of that. She acknowledges the frailties of human beings. She acknowledges the attractions of the flesh and accepts them in her own way, particularly with one of the older children who's just kind of blossoming into womanhood. The interesting thing about that is that diametrically opposed forces, admittedly, the Rachel Cooper is a little bit of a Bible basher, but I don't think she rams it down people's throats. I think she uses it as an object lesson for the children to get through life rather than the way Harry Powell uses it, which is talking to God and having a justification. There are two sides to the religious thing in this as well. There's Harry Powell's one where he listens to a voice in his head and acts upon it, and there's the other one which uses the lessons of the Bible to help people through the secular things they've got to get through in the day. And I find that very, as an atheist, of course, I find that very interesting as well, that kind of two sides of religion, where one is practical and based in reality and the other one is very much not so. And Robert Mitchum, of course, is one of my favourite actors. I've got a signed autographed picture of Robert Mitchum not 3 metres from where I'm sitting, and that's one of my treasured possessions. But in this film, he's definitely goes to town. He realises that, I think Mitchum as an actor was sensitive enough, and if you see things like Ryan's Daughter, where he was dreadfully miscast but somehow seems to essay the vulnerability needed for the character, even though physically he was totally wrong for it, I think Mitchum was a sensitive enough actor to know what was needed. They needed a big bad wolf. They needed a charismatic charmer who could seduce a woman like Willa. In a sense, seduce her into doing what he wanted rather than to fulfilling her needs. So there's a kind of sexual dynamic there which is very obvious in one scene in the film, which shatters Willa's character and really sets her off onto a path that ultimately leads to a not very good ending. But one of the things that really interested me too about this film is that kind of juxtaposition between the realistic and the expressionistic parts of things. The journey of the children down the river in this little open skiff when they're passing bullfrogs and foxes and other wildlife and just meandering down a rural landscape to escape from a monster. It does have that kind of Hansel and Gretel fairy tale aspect to it, which is fascinating. It doesn't clash. That's the weird thing. I can't figure out why. And I think that in some ways it should. And I think in some ways the cartoonish aspects of some moments of Robert Mitchum's Harry Powell should really cause a car accident in this film. They should smash things to pieces, but it doesn't. It's going, oh, okay. When he makes animal noises, you realise that it is a feral, mad, almost rabid animal that is chasing these children, who only has its own agendas and only has its own survival and only has its own needs to consider. I mean, I think the bold choices, and maybe there are times, some people may think there are times when they don't always work, but I think taking the bold choices in a film like this is much better than kind of underplaying them and understating them and maybe not getting the message across so well. So there's not too much else to say about Night of the Hunter. If it isn't in your movie collection, get it in your movie collection. It's one of those great films. And I think cinema is the poorer for the fact that they didn't let him, as the code was loosening up in the late 50s. He could have made some fantastic films. He'd given the opportunity. He could have brought Brecht to cinema. He was very much a big Brecht fan. His Galileo apparently was fantastic. Night of the Hunter is arguably Mitchum's best role. There are probably a couple of others that go close to it. I think I kind of like him in Heaven Knows Mrs. Allison, even though it's more of a conventional action film. And I do see him in Ryan's Daughter, and I kind of realise that at the time Mitchum was just about suicidal. And that kind of pain, and like I said about a couple of podcasts ago about Warren Oates in Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, that kind of rawness to things. There's nothing more striking than when a tough guy actor appears emotionally vulnerable, and probably in a sense is. They've got to be able to show that weakness, they've got to be able to show that frailty and that human doubt and that just sheer humanness that is much more interesting than seeing, say, a sensitive actor playing sensitive. You expect that note to be in their repertoire, but with a tough guy actor or ostensibly a tough guy actor to play vulnerable, I always find, if it's done well, I always find it much more striking and much more to the point, much more important than it is with a lot of other actors. Another interesting aspect of this film too is the fact that Lawton didn't direct the children very much. The children in the film, Billy Chapin and the little girl who was played by Sarah Jane Bruce, are such a crucial part of the film, even though, of course, Billy Chapin being slightly older is the kind of centre of the film. Lawton, for some reason, found himself unable to direct them. He was too used to, I think, to directing adults in the theatre. And ultimately, the direction of the children was left to Robert Mitchum. So he encouraged them, nurtured them, got the best performances out of them, even though he was playing the monster in the film. I think he built up such a rapport with the children and was able to assist. This is what I mean about the collaboration. He collaborated with Lawton in this film by basically being the director and the coach for the two child actors in this film. One of the other interesting things is ostensibly the script was written by James Agee, the movie critic turned screenwriter who had made a number of other films. But from everything I can read, and I've got a couple of different reference books here, one of which is Simon Keller's Charles Lawton, A Difficult Actor, and the other one is Mitchum, The Film Career of Robert Mitchum by Bruce Crowther. And from everything I can read on this, Agee was pretty much at the end of his career and very much an alcoholic at the time. Apparently spent a lot of the time on the floor sleeping off the booze. And Lawton himself, in about a 3 or 4 week period, wrote most of the script himself based on the outlines they'd kind of got together. So in a sense, the film is in more ways than anyone else's Lawton's film. And his knowledge of cinema, of drama, of acting really strengthens what we have here. I've digressed a little bit there, so sorry about that. Definitely see this one. If it isn't in your collection, get it. If you haven't seen it, you're in for a treat. And I always like the fact that some of the people listening may not have seen a certain film because they then got the joy and the wonder of seeing it for the first time. It's an important film. Get the book if you can. And there's not too much else to say about it. I'll just leave you with another clip of Robert Mitchum going, Bugfuck Crazy in The Night of the Hunter, and then we'll move on to talk about Sullivan's travels.
Ah, little lad, you're staring at my fingers. Would you like me to tell you the little story of right hand, left hand? The story of good and evil? H-A-T-E. It was with this left hand that old brother Cain struck the blow that laid his brother low. L-O-V-E. You see these fingers, dear hearts? These fingers has veins that run straight to the soul of man. The right hand, friends, the hand of love. Now watch and I'll show you the story of life. These fingers, dear hearts, is always a warring and a tugging, one against the other. Now watch them. Old brother left hand. Left hand hates a fighting, and it looks like love's a goner. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Hot dog loves a winning. Yes, sirree. It's love that won. And old left hand hate is down for the count.
Sullivan's Travels comes at us from 1941. It's an American comedy written and directed by Preston Sturges. It's a satire about a movie director played by Joel McRae who longs to make a socially relevant drama but eventually learns that comedies are his most valuable contribution to society. The film features one of Veronica Lake's first leading roles. The title is a reference to Gulliver's Travels, a famous novel by satirist Jonathan Swift about another journey of self-discovery. In 1990, Sullivan's Travels was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being a culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Yeah, and it's a fun film. It's a comedy that has some moments of incredible depth. It has bits that surprise me every time I watch it because I forget about them until I watch it again. I've only watched it twice, so far I have. And it's one of those movies that you see a character like Joel McRae acting in a film like this. And he's got a deft touch at the light comedy stuff. He is quite funny in the film. And you think, this guy went on after a couple more films, including Palm Beach Story for Preston Sturges again. After that, he made westerns. He only did westerns where he was playing serious, lantern-jawed, upright western characters. And I think it's partly because Joel McRae, as an actor, didn't have any confidence in his acting ability, really. He really didn't consider himself a good actor, but in this film, it shows that he has a terrific light touch with comedy. It's a surprise that he didn't go on to do more of that. Maybe he decided to go for the bucks, which a lot of people do, and I can't really knock them for that, but I think he should have done more comedies. I'll just give you a little bit of an example at the start where he makes the decision to go off and become a hobo with 10 cents in his pocket just so he can see real human suffering and make a significant contribution cinematically to the American cinema, all that sort of stuff.
How about making ants in your plants of 1941? You can have Bob Hope, Mary Martin.
Maybe Bing Crosby.
The Avid Dancers.
Maybe Jack Benny and Rochester.
A big name band.
What? Oh, no. I want to make Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But I'll tell you what I'm going to do first. I'm going down to the wardrobe and get some old clothes, some old shoes.
Huh?
And I'm going to start out with 10 cents in my pocket.
What?
I don't know where I'm going, but I'm not coming back till I know what trouble is.
What?
Don't worry, you can take me off salary.
Who's talking about taking your salary?
So long, and thanks for the
idea. Now, wait a minute. Don't be so impulsive. How soon you'll be back?
I don't know. Maybe a week, maybe a month, maybe a year. Don't worry about me, and thanks, Dracula. You gave me a great idea.
I gave you...
So anyway, Sullivan, played by Joel McRae, decides to go out and become a hobo. The first year, Tom, is followed by a whole entourage of Hollywood types, journalists and publicity people and studio functionaries and all sorts of people like that who follow him in this enormous, basically primitive Winnebago kind of caravan thing behind him. And, you know, every time he tries to get away, he ends up getting hitchhiking a ride back to Hollywood. He spends overnight in a home, the home of a couple of spinstery, or one's a widow, one's a spinster types, for some rather humorous effects about the sexual needs of spinsters, which is quite amusing. And nonetheless, he always ends up back in Hollywood. Now, one of the interesting things I liked in this film, and I found it really surprising, and I really like the fact that some character actors get to have a kind of their own moment in the sun in this film, is when his valet and his butler both have their say about the idea of him going off on the tramp with 10 cents in his pocket to find out what real suffering's about. I'll just play a little bit of that because it's beautiful writing, I think, and I think it's also a way of showing what kind of a naive twit he is, and that some of the minor characters in the film have a backstory of their own and have a worldview of their own, which is not the same as that of their boss.
Sir. Good morning, Burroughs. How do you like it?
I don't like it at all, sir. Fancy dress, I take it.
What's the matter with it?
I have never been sympathetic to a caricaturing of the poor and needy, sir.
Who's caricaturing?
Burroughs doesn't know about the expedition, sir.
I'm going out on the road to find out what it's like to be poor and needy, and then I'm going to make a picture
about it. If you'll permit me to say so, sir, the subject is not an interesting one. The poor know all about poverty, and only the morbid rich would find the topic glamorous.
But I'm doing it for the poor, don't you understand?
I doubt if they would appreciate it, sir. They rather resent the invasion of their privacy, I believe quite properly, sir. Also, such excursions can be extremely dangerous, sir. I worked for a gentleman once who likewise, with two friends, accoutred themselves as you have, sir, and then went out for a lark. They have not been heard from since.
That was some time ago.
1912, sir.
Uh-huh.
You see, sir, rich people and theorists, who are usually rich people, think of poverty in the negative, as the lack of riches, as disease might be called the lack of health. But it isn't, sir. Poverty is not the lack of anything, but a positive plague, virulent in itself, contagious as cholera, with filth, criminality, vice, and despair as only a few of its symptoms. It is to be stayed away from, even for purposes of study. It is to be shunned.
Well, you seem to have made quite a study of it.
Quite unwillingly, sir. Will that be all, sir?
Thanks.
Very good, sir.
It gets a little bit gruesome every once in a while.
Always reading books, sir.
Of course, in any comedy, there has to be a girl there, or at least a gay partner if you're doing a modern comedy. But in this case, the girl's played by Veronica Lake, and she is great in this film. I saw her recently in I Married a Witch with Frederick March, and she was just as good in that. Beautiful comedy actress. She has, it's one of those things, kind of like Ida Lupino in a way, in the sense that she's very much a woman who stands up for herself, and in that way we can relate to the character a lot more than we can some other contemporary roles. She's very much got the self-reliance and the equal of a man kind of attitude that very much plays well in this century more than it did in the last. And she meets him in a diner, and I'll play the bit where they meet, because I kind of like this kind of meet-cute stuff. You get it also in The Lady Eve, one of Preston Sturges' other films, where Barbara Stanwyck meets up with Henry Fonda. But I'll play this because it's just too good not to play, and then I'll talk about how this film has an interesting arc. After they get together, they drop the entourage, and Sullivan actually learns something about the way the world really is.
Good morning.
Morning. Give me a cup of coffee and a donut, if that's enough for it.
You want it plain or with powdered sugar?
Oh, with a little cream.
The sinker?
Oh, just any kind. There's some rolls. I don't care.
Yes, sir.
Give him some ham and eggs.
Yes, ma'am.
That's very kind of you, sister, but I'm not hungry. A cup of coffee and a sinker will fix me up fine.
Don't be a sucker. Give him some ham and eggs. The way I'm fixed, 35 cents isn't going to make any difference. Here.
Thanks. Things a little tough, huh?
Wouldn't be sitting in an owl wagon for local color. They locked me out of my room.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, things are tough everywhere. War in Europe, strikes over here, there's no work, there's no food.
Drink your coffee while it's hot.
What'd they lock you out of your room for?
Did I ask you any questions?
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
You been in Hollywood long?
Long enough.
Trying to crash the movies or something?
Something like that.
I guess that's pretty hard to do, huh?
I guess so. I never got close enough to find out.
Oh, sorry.
Say, who's being sorry for who? Am I buying you the eggs or are you buying me the eggs?
I'd just like to repay you for them.
All right, give me a letter of introduction to Lubitsch.
I might be able to do that, too. Who's Lubitsch?
Drink your coffee.
Can you act?
What'd you say?
I said, can you act?
Sure I can act. Would you like me to give you a recitation?
Go ahead.
Skip it. My next act will be an impersonation of a young lady going home from the thumb.
In that outfit?
How about your own outfit?
I mean, haven't you got a car?
No, have you?
No, but...
Then don't get ritzy. And I'll tell you some other things I haven't got. I haven't got a yacht or a pearl necklace or a fur coat or a country seat or even a winter seat. I could use a new girdle, too.
I wish I could give you some of the things you need.
You wouldn't be trying to lead me astray, would you? You know, the nice thing about buying food for a man is that you don't have to laugh at his jokes. Just think, if you were some big shot like a casting director or something, I'd be staring into your bridgework saying, yes, Mr. Smearcase, no, Mr. Smearcase, not really, Mr. Smearcase. Oh, Mr. Smearcase, that's my knee. Give Mr. Smearcase another cup of coffee, make it two. Want a piece of pie?
No, thanks, kid.
Why, Mr. Smearcase, aren't you getting a little familiar?
I like that piece because it's a tiny little satire on the Hollywood studio system and has put in the voice of an unsuccessful actress, which is a beautiful piece of work. And again, it's a lovely piece of writing. Veronica Lake had some problems in the film, the first one of which was she was about a foot and a half shorter than John McCrae and had to stand on boxes various times during production just so they could meet eye to eye on the screen. One of the other problems was when they made the film, she was about 6 months pregnant, and the costume designer Edith Head had to kind of work around her pregnancy and design costumes that didn't show the fact that she was pretty much seriously up the duff at the time. And another problem was that she didn't seem to get on with a lot of the crew and didn't get on with Joel McRae and also Preston Sturges, so there's a little bit of a tension on the set as well. Weird thing is it doesn't show. The pregnancy doesn't show. The height difference doesn't really matter in the film. And if she had any problems at all, they definitely stayed off the screen. It's she's great in this film. And one of those women who's an equal to the man she's with in a lot of ways that weren't always visible in comedies from the early 1940s. This is just before America got into the war. They were aware that a war was coming and they weren't sure which way America was going to jump, and the depression was still very much with America. And which leads me into the kind of act two of Sullivan's travels, where Sullivan actually gets into some serious trouble. First he and the girl, and then he by himself ends up pretty much as low as a man can go in that time and that place. And there's some montages there which have a beautiful score behind them. The film is scored beautifully. There are a couple of different places in this film where there's no dialogue. There's just visual montages with music played almost as sound effects, and as a mood setting part to them. And there are some of them in soup kitchens and on the street and in hobo jungles and places like that, where it does begin to feel a bit like a documentary, which just happens to have two people whose faces are recognisable in it. And it's a big condemnation of not doing anything to help these people. And the scene when John McCrae goes to see a movie, I'm not going to do any more of a spoiler than that. If you haven't seen it, see it, and you'll know what I mean. Where, when he's at his lowest ebb, he's taken to see a movie, is one of the most striking and, in a lot of ways, poignant pieces of American cinema at the time. It goes against everything that we think we know about the time it was made in. The attitude of races to each other, the attitude of people to criminals, the attitudes of rich movie makers to the public. Sturges really does kick the ass out of those preconceptions that we have of those things, and puts together a powerful piece of cinema in the context of what, in its shell, is a romantic comedy. This is a fantastic film. It's one of those films that I've said this once or twice before in the podcast. It's one of those films that I don't want to watch too often because it'll lose the magic. I want to know that it's there, and I know I'll dip back into it again at some stage, but I don't want to do it too often so they get used to the wonderful things that are in there, so they become ordinary to me. And this film is definitely one of those films which has something to say, but says it in an entertaining and amusing way, and says it in a way that is kind of hard to refute. It's hard to argue against it, what it says. They must have got some fantastic character actors in this film, or they got some real down-and-out people to be in certain parts of this movie. They got a commendation from the NAACP at the time for its enlightened portrayal of what they then called coloured men and women of America. But for its time, there was such an enlightened way of letting people be part of the film and showing them as human beings, and as human beings equal to, if not better than, a lot of other human beings who happen to be white. There are bits of it that almost make you cry. It's really a strong film wrapped up around with a romantic comedy wrapped around it. And, of course, it's a satire of Hollywood, but it's also a social document, which is kind of crazy. If somebody pitched this kind of film to a studio now, even if it was Miramax or something like that, unless they referred to Sullivan's Travels as a template, and of course Brother Where Art Thou was a Coen Brothers film. I think Miramax might have been the distributors of that, but I could be wrong. But in spite of that, I don't think you could get a film like this to float these days, because it's too many different things, and it would be very easy for those different styles of filmmaking and different threads to not come together well. But in this film, they definitely do. Now, John McCrae went on to make another film with Sturges, Palm Beach Story, which I haven't seen yet, but I do have a copy of, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing that now. I don't think it's going to be up to Sullivan's Travels, but I don't doubt for a second that it's going to be an entertaining film to see. So that's about all for Sullivan's Travels now. See the film. Fall in love with Veronica Lake if you're a guy and you're straight. If not, fall in love with John McCrae. And just enjoy it. Enjoy the dialogue. Enjoy the way that it has an amazing second act. And let me know what you think. I'm going to get Sal to do the blurb at the end of it, telling you how to contact us. It's cultguru@gmail.com. But if you don't know that, I'll stick the Sal stuff on the end. And I'm going to take a little break. And then when I come back, I'm going to give you a few hints and annotations to Inglourious Basterds, which refer back to classic films of the early half of the 20th century.
While the city sleeps, every night he creeps, just surveying his domain. He roams around like he owns the town. He's the king, he makes that plain. He knows every trick, doesn't miss a lick when it comes to keeping fat. Some city slicker, no one is quicker than a bad darn cat. Every nook and cranny and garbage can he inspects so thoroughly. When he's on his rounds, nothing's out of bounds to his curiosity. He can smile and purr at a pretty hurt till she don't know where she's at. Nose like a Geiger, oh, what a tagger, a bat darn cat.
Okay, that was Bobby Troop with That Darn Cat. Bobby Troop is one of the luckiest human beings in the world. He was married to Julie London, and she was hot. Anyway, on to the annotations for Inglourious Basterds. Now, I did get an email from, he said, looking up the list, Troy Date. And he asked me to see if I could kind of get you guys hip to some of the movie references that were in Inglourious Basterds. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole list. I made up a list of about 3 pages, and then I did some web surfing and found out that the guys at Scarecrow Video have made up a list anyway. So I kind of duplicated the effort. I reinvented the wheel a bit. So if you go to Scarecrow Video and in their search area type in Before They Were Bastards, with an ERDS on the end, you'll find this whole list. So I wasted 2 or 3 hours going through the movie and figuring it all out and doing a little bit of Wikipedia-ing, and then I found out there was already done. So thanks to the guys at Scarecrow Video up in Seattle, which is kind of, I think, where Troy comes from, up that part of the world. And oddly enough, I have been to Scarecrow Video. It's an enormous video shop in Seattle. And I got taken there in 1998 when I was up that way. And they had rooms and rooms full of, at that stage, VHS tapes. And the guy I was with, a really nice guy called Jerry, said, you can pick one movie, which for a movie buff was torture. I wanted to pick 50 movies to watch, but he said, pick one movie. And I think I picked The Silencers with Dean Martin, but Anyway, here's the list. I'm going to go with the obvious stuff first and get through a bit of it. I won't go through, as I said, won't go through it all because there are a number of pages here, but I'll just give you a little bit of a taster of a lot of the movie references that Tarantino put into Inglourious Basterds. We'll go with the obvious one. Now, Mike Myers' character's name was Ed Fennec, which was a nod to Edwidge Fennec, the I think she may have been Maltese actress who was in a lot of nudie films in the 1960s. So that kind of Colonel Blimp character that Mike Myers played was actually referenced to a rather buxom 1960s, 1970s actress. Okay, Michael Fassbender's character, Lieutenant Archie Hickox, the guy that goes on Operation Kino to Paris to try to kill lots of Nazis and join up with the bastards, and doesn't do too good at that. His character is basically supposed to be George Sanders. So they Tarantino and Fassbender watched a lot of George Sanders movies, and they kind of took the kind of languid, stylish characterization that he brought to that from George Sanders. One of the other things about that particular part of it is that bit where they do the accents and things like that, that was Tarantino's kind of piss take on movies like When Eagles Dare, where all of the guys who go into the mountain fortress seem to speak perfect German. And Tarantino, of course, brought up the idea of, what about regional accents? If they speak perfect German, no one's going to know where they're from. Which kind of leads into that thing, I'm not sure whether I mentioned it, where Arnold Schwarzenegger wanted to dub the Terminator movies into German himself because as an Austrian he spoke it. But apparently Austrians sound like yokels to German-speaking people, so he wasn't allowed to dub his own voice into the Terminator movies. The Nation's Pride film, within the film, the one that the sniper character films, which is the movie premiere that all the Nazis go to, was kind of the style of it and the cinematography of it that Eli Roth, who was one of the actors in the film, but also as a film director, of course, he was basing a lot of that on the style and the inspiration of it was Battleship Potemkin. So there's a little bit of Battleship Potemkin in that as well. Of course, there's that little bit at the start when Shoshana flees away from the Jew hunter, and you see her fleeing away framed in the doorway of the Frenchman's cottage. That, of course, is a reference to The Searchers. Some of the scenes where the bastards are basically beating the shit out of, scalping and killing Nazis, there's that kind of group camaraderie thing, which is a kind of nod to Samuel Fuller's The Big Red One. The bit where they show you why nitrate film goes up like a bomb and they have a little clip from another movie, that's actually from Sabotage, the Hitchcock film in the 1930s starring Oscar Homolka and Sylvia Sidney. So they used a little chunk of that to demonstrate how people in the 1930s saw celluloid film. You weren't allowed to take them on buses, which is an important plot point in Sabotage. If you haven't seen that one, definitely do so. Hugo Stiglitz, the character played by, what's his name, Till Swergert in Inglourious Basterds, is actually a nod to a Mexican actor whose name, oddly enough, was Hugo Stiglitz, a Mexican character actor who starred in a whole bunch of not too big budget action films in the 1950s and 1960s in and around Mexico. Then, of course, there's the name that Shoshana takes on when she becomes the owner of the small cinema in Paris, Emmanuel Mimieux. Of course, that's a nod to the Emmanuel films and also Yvette Mimieux, who starred in a couple of films with Rod Taylor, who, of course, played Winston Churchill. The two films she starred with Rod Taylor in, of course, were The Time Machine and Dark of the Sun, which Taylor and Mimieux starred in while they're under contract to MGM. The sniper character, the Frederick Zola character in the film, the Nazi propaganda sniper, is kind of a turnabout version of Audie Murphy, the most decorated soldier in World War II, who went on to have a movie career and in real life wasn't necessarily the nicest of people. Of course, there's the most obvious movie reference as well, Lieutenant Aldo Raine, played by Brad Pitt, a nod to Aldo Raine, the chunky character actor who ended up getting on the piss a little too much and played character roles in porno movies right at the end of his career. In the tavern scene where they're all the Nazis are playing a game where they stick the names of celebrities on their heads with cards and try to guess which celebrity they is by asking questions of the people around them. There's a few references in that. Of course, one of the obvious ones being Edgar Wallace in there. King Kong was in there. Winnetou, which was a bunch of novels. It's based on a bunch of novels, Old Shatterhand, written by a guy called Karl May, and they were westerns, but written in German, and they were made into German westerns in the 1960s, starring Lex Barker. So there's a reference to Winnetou, who's like the faithful Indian companion to Old Shatterhand, the cowboy hero of the film. The Frederick Zola character mentions that he prefers a comedian called Max Linder than he did to Chaplin. Max Linder was a French silent movie actor who did a lot of comedies in the early part of the 20th century. He was Jewish, actually, and one of the tragedies is he was deemed unfit for fighting in World War I and became a dispatch driver and was seriously injured during World War I, and his career was never quite the same, and unfortunately that led to a lot of depression for Max Linder, and he ended up committing suicide in 1925, and he and his wife together. So there was... He's kind of a tragic figure, but it's the sort of person that somebody in the 1940s would remember seeing his films in the silent era. He did them from about 1907 till 1924 was his most last film. So having that is kind of a bit of verisimilitude in there. It shows that the people are of their time and not of our time, which is one of the faults that a lot of period movies have these days. People in them act like they're 21st century people, rather than people of the time in which the movie is set. And in Inglourious Basterds, Goebbels mentions a movie called Lucky Kids, and Shoshana shows a print of this film to the Nazis when they come to examine a theatre. And someone voices an appreciation of Lillian Harvey in that film, and Goebbels screams at them never to mention her name again. She was very much an anti-fascist and pissed off Goebbels enormously in the 1930s, and never made another film in Germany after that, and basically snubbed UFA and the whole German film industry because of the Nazi involvement in it. So it's very much in as a part of film history that Goebbels hated her guts. Bridget Helm's name appears in the guessing game. She was, of course, Maria in Metropolis. There's a bit in the movie when Marcel, the Shoshana's lover, says, "Ooh la la, Daniel Darrieux." That's a reference, of course, to Daniel Darrieux, the famous French actress. I won't go on with any more of that, but if you want to go with it, type in Scarecrow Video into Google or whichever your search engine of your choice is, and then when you get there, type Before They Were Bastards with an ERDS, and you'll find the full list that the guys and women at Scarecrow Video put together. It's a terrific list, and if you have it sitting there while you're watching the film on DVD, and if you haven't got it on DVD, why not? You'll find that it's very useful, and there's an extra... It's that thing I've mentioned before about having metadata encrypted in a movie. You have that extra level of data in there for people who want to puzzle it out, and it kind of makes the world of the film a little more three-dimensional and a little more considered than you might think it is otherwise. Anyway, that's about it for the podcast. No, it's gone on longer than a lot of the other ones, so I do apologise for that if you're bored shitless. And if you are, I'll give you the contact details in a moment. You can tell me that. Anyway, I'll be back again in 3 weeks' time. I'm not sure whether I'll be doing the other two films I've got for the Listener's Choice podcast, Walkabout and Slaughterhouse-Five, but I will get to them, and I will take a look at them in a future podcast. I've got the idea of a couple of things I might want to look at for the next cast. Not going to give away too much except to say it was Merchant Ivory's first film and a lot of people don't like it, but I do. I hope you enjoy your movie watching. Let me know what you think. Take it easy. If you're in colder parts of the world, rug up and stay out of snowdrifts. If you're in the places around the hotter areas like I am, keep your liquids up and stay out of the sun. And I will be back in 3 weeks' time with another hour of creative waffling. So I'll catch you later, and here's Sal with the contact details.
Paleo Cinema is a 3-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, and is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.